In this episode of Startups, the Rest of Us, I'm going to be talking to Marie Poulin about transitioning from services to product and then back to services. This is Startups, the Rest of Us, episode 379. Welcome to Startups, the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Marie.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Marie?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent. So wanted to have you on the show and talk to you a little bit, because I know that you and your business partner have launched a SaaS, and I thought that it'd be really interesting to share that with the listeners. And for anyone who's not familiar with who Marie is, I'll give you the very brief rundown. But Marie's the chief designer and the strategist behind a software product called Doki. And the company that runs that is called Okidoki. And they're a digital agency that she runs with her husband, and they help business owners to plan, design, develop, and launch online products, services, and experiences for their customers. So the product that you've launched is Doki, and the company behind it is We Are Okidoki. Is that correct?
Yeah, Okidoki is our company.
Okay, so it's a little confusing to just kind of look at that.
Tell me about it. This is something that we learned when we were coming up with the name for our product, and we thought it would be very clever to have a sort of overarching name, but it has led to some confusion as people have referred to the software as Okidoki. So it's been a bit of a challenge as we try to separate our software from our services, and just over time, we've now started to merge the two together. So it's a bit funky to explain, but that's my interim explanation.
I think there's a lot of people who've probably run into that where they're trying to be clever. And I've done this myself. You try to be clever and then you realize afterwards, you know, I should have just not bothered.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell the listeners a little bit about what your software actually does, because I think it's a little unclear from the description that I gave of what your platform does. Like what is it that the software does for your customers?
So essentially, it's an online course delivery platform, and it also works for people who, say, are launching coaching programs, masterminds, anything that has a course component but also might have one-on-one interactions or even one-to-many interactions. So a course delivery platform is the easiest way to describe it, and it's just a way for people to charge their customers to access their course materials.
Now, is this stuff that is dripped out over time, or is it like, you know, you deliver the, somebody pays X dollars for the course and then they get everything all at once? You know, can you do either or?
Yeah, so the beauty is there's a number of different formats. There's at least four different ways you can deliver the material. So resource libraries allow someone to access all of the material, and the teacher can just, you know, ad hoc, add content whenever they want. You can drip it out over a schedule. And one of the features that we did build, and this was mostly because we work with a lot of coaches, but we basically have a timed launch. We call that classes. So let's say your course doesn't launch until September, but you want to be able to sell your course and have people log in, but the material itself doesn't actually unlock until a fixed date. So that way you can kind of stagger people and have people signing up over the course of weeks, but that content only gets delivered on a key date. So we have a couple different ways that people use it, but our biggest users really are coaches who launch sort of like a multi-week, multi-month program.
That's really interesting, because when you're talking about that, it just reminds me of when Rob and I built the Micropreneur Academy back in 2009, 2010, and we looked around and there was not something that did that at the time. You know, we looked everywhere. We were trying to find stuff. What we ended up doing was hacking together WordPress with a bunch of plugins to kind of make it work. And we had somebody build a custom plugin that would allow customers to purchase a set of the subset of the course, and then they could buy ahead to essentially pay to get to the next month of access. But we couldn't do that in the beginning because we were building things as we were selling it. But it sounds like you've got a lot of work and effort put into this. How is it that you came up with the idea? Where did that come from?
Well, kind of like you, actually, in banging together a number of WordPress plugins to kind of make that experience work. A lot of my work was initially as web design for a lot of coaching clients. So I was working with a lot of people that had different types of courses and coaching programs, memberships, and that sort of thing. And that was one of the most common challenges, is people wanted to launch their program on a key date, but they wanted to accept payment much earlier. So we, in a way, we were kind of, you know, trying to solve our own problem. And I asked Ben, I was like, there's got to be a better way to do this, because we're getting a lot of similar project inquiries, and it's really, really time consuming to as you know, like integrate all the pieces, whether it's the email marketing, payment pieces, you know, accepting PayPal, dripping the course out over, you know, different weeks. And it was just getting to be a bit of a beast. And as I was asking Ben about this, I'm like, there's got to be an easier way to do this. And he's like, why don't you build your own software? Which, I mean, I'm not a developer. That's not something I was about to do. But we kind of joked about it. We're like, maybe we'll just build our own. And we started doing some research to see if anything out there was really doing anything like that. And there were a few, like even like Rizuku or sort of webinar type platforms that were trying to do something like that, but nothing that had this kind of complex use case that we were seeing as a pretty common use case. So we took it upon ourselves to try and build it ourselves. And I think Ben spent a couple weeks, months, maybe tinkering in the evenings and weekends, just trying to see like what would a first version of this look like and kind of what would it take. And we got excited about the idea, and we very quickly realized, you know, a few weeks of just working in the evenings and weekends was not going to cut it. So yeah, I can go into a bit more detail, but that's basically the beginning. That's how it started. And we decided we were going to give Ben that time to work on it. So I think we gave him about, I don't know, like I'd say a year of just like first tinkering. And then once my signature program that I was running took off, we basically used that to fund a year of Ben not taking on clients and focusing 100% on the product.
So I guess to step back and kind of summarize that, you've got both you and him are doing consulting and services work for your client base. Was it an overlapping client base? Were you both servicing like the same customers, or did you each kind of do your own thing?
I'd say 95% of it was we were doing our own thing. It was almost like having two companies. You know, we each sort of had our own clients. Ben tended to work with a bit more software startups and agencies in the States. And I tended to work a lot with sort of coaches and entrepreneurs on my side. So it was very rare that we would work on a project together, but I sort of had the front end skill set, the marketing, the design chops, and Ben had the technical expertise. And at some point we're like, this is kind of silly. Like, why wouldn't we put our skills together and build something together that serves a greater audience?
So you've come up with this idea of like kind of allocating time for Ben to sit down and work on the development itself. What was it that made you guys decide and have the confidence that you could have him take that step and step away from consulting completely and be able to transition your businesses from services into product?
Maybe a bit of blissful ignorance over confidence. So around the same time that we had this product idea, I had launched a mentorship program of my own called Digital Strategy School. And that got to a point where it was bringing in a solid 10 to 15K a month pretty regularly. And that was on top of other client work that I was doing. So we got to a point where we felt confident enough that even if Ben didn't bring in any revenue for 6 months, a year, and he had some business savings as well, we sort of thought, well, let's give ourselves some runway and let's try it out. Let's try our hand at the software. And Ben was excited to, you know, experiment with some new technology as well. And so it was just kind of curiosity and just wanting to build a bit more of a sustainable business and bring in something hopefully a bit more automated.
I think that's the classic sign that most people who are running some sort of services business run into. They say, well, yeah, let's do a product instead because it's not reliant on our time. And I think there's a lot of people who are doing the products and they see the people who are building those services business that are kind of taking off and it's quote unquote easy money and the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. I talk to people who are on both sides of that. And it's interesting to hear, like, you know, you ran into the one direction, but I also hear from the other side that people who are running this product businesses sometimes wish they were doing a services business because it might be easier.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no one size fits all approach. And this is definitely something that we've learned because I've had an easier time selling $1,000 course with an online community than we have had, you know, getting someone to commit $29 or $49 a month for a tool that helps grow their business. So that's been kind of fascinating for us to see. And so services has come really easy to us. And so, you know, between Ben and I, we've both been able to get some pretty high value, you know, retainer clients. And so that's been kind of easy for us. Like if we get a client on the phone, we can usually get the project and it's been pretty straightforward for us. So products for us was just like a whole other learning curve. Like I certainly didn't know any of the terms like churn or MRR, like what any of that meant. You know, we just sort of thought like, it's like services, but at scale. And it was just really not at all. It just a totally different ballgame, as you probably know. So it was a bit of an experiment for us, but again, we never fully disassociated from services. We were kind of doing both in tandem. And then, of course, once we started getting people on the platform, we were also working one-on-one with a lot of those people. And as people were using the platform and needing help to get their courses launched or to make their courses better, or how do I market my course now that it's, using your platform, it started to open up all these opportunities. And we wondered, like, where are these gaps and what do we need to fill in? And looks like we need to step up our one-on-one services, because suddenly people that are launching their own courses are now turning to us for our expertise. And, I'd worked with clients behind the scenes doing this and setting up, strategies, but I'm not an instructional designer. I'm not an expert on that side of things. So that kind of opened up a whole other world of, well, how do we fill that gap and make sure that we're offering these complementary services that can support the SaaS, even if we don't feel like the experts to do that? So yeah, that's opened up a whole new other educational streams and one-on-one consulting, because we've partnered up with an instructional designer, and that's been really amazing.
So I guess, is a good assumption that I could make here to say that you probably did not go about a lot of validation before deciding to go down this path? Because it sounds like you did some prototyping. It looked like a good fit. You didn't really see anybody else who in the market who was doing it. You were hacking together a bunch of stuff and said, hey, this looks like a great idea.
Yeah, we had our one-on-one clients and clients that I had worked with that had expressed the interest and expressed the need. I'd heard people talk about it in forums and, I noticed this general need, but I wasn't sort of diving deep and doing real customer research and, hopping on and doing virtual coffee dates with people and just interviewing people. I really didn't know at that point what it really looked like to do that level of product validation. So I would say, we certainly didn't do as much product validation, and we just relied on what we'd heard from friends and colleagues and whatnot. So we had a pretty small network, and our small network was using the product, but it was like, oh crap, like how do we actually scale this? And how do we scale this when we have people that are similar players, and sort of more household names, if you will, like the Teachables or Thinkific or Rizuku. Like there's tons of other platforms out there, and people would say, well, how do you differ from Teachable? You have to say, well, we don't have the content marketing chops to keep up with a company like that. So how do we compete in a market that's really growing fast? So we didn't do the level of validation that we would do if we were starting from scratch, for sure.
Right. So, and it sounds like your early adopters and the people that you initially did talk to were really mostly your consulting clients anyway, correct?
Yeah, consulting clients, friends of friends, colleagues, people that, I was pretty active in a few online communities. And so there were a few people that had their own communities and sort of forums. And some of those leaders actually were using our platform. And so when they were recommending to their members, this is the platform that we use. That was a really amazing strategy, but we didn't really double down on it. We didn't have any kind of processes in place to do that kind of outreach. We just kind of, in a way, we relied on a bit of luck and friends helping us out, but that wasn't a long-term strategy for actually growing.
So I guess to kind of go into the part where you're getting into this initial version, Ben has taken time off from his consulting and kind of pushed that off to the side. And you've decided that he can take this 6 months, 12 months to get the product off the ground, essentially. How long was it before he had something that was usable that you could put in front of people?
It's hard to know the exact dates, because again, we had like a few months here where it was tinkering, and then maybe 6 months of full time, and then maybe a few months where he had a couple clients on the go. But I'd say from the time we had the idea and first started tinkering to actually getting our full beta ready, it might have been a year or a year and a half. Well, like we sort of had an alpha, I would say, that was just sort of our very bare bones version. But I think it took about a year, year and a half to get to a beta that we didn't feel embarrassed to have people signing up for.
And this is the phrase that I try to use with people. And I try to make it gentle, but I also know that it's in some ways intentionally not. But was it objectively bad anyway?
Well, it's really hard to quantify. I think it's missing like user experience elements. There are certain like design decisions that we would have loved to do, but I think it was a great functional first version. I think our alpha was
kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah. I mean, the alpha was pretty rough, but I think the beta was really great. And I think, Ben was really nervous, I think, about the first people, getting on there. So much so that initially we had this like request access. And of course, you know, we'd get like one request a month, which was insane. I'm like, we need to get people using this thing. We have to actually see, like watch someone use it, right? We need to get people on there. Why are we making it difficult for people to sign up? And I think Ben was scared. It was our first SaaS and we didn't necessarily know, well, we didn't know anything about anything when it came to software. So finally, when we made the switch and it was, you know, sign up for a trial. And even those decisions are difficult, right? Like, do you just make it free right off the bat? Do you, you know, we were giving it to like our close friends and colleagues who we knew could benefit from it just to get them. Because, you know, there's that friction. Like once someone has already put all of their materials and assets on your platform, it's a lot harder to switch, right? It's sort of like they become invested in using the product. So we thought, let's get a few key people using this and talking about it first. But it was a while before I think we had the confidence to open it up to strangers, which is so important, right?
I agree, but I also think that, you know, there's all these reasons that I think that are easy to come up with as to why you don't want to push it out there or why you don't want to add somebody on it. And some of them are just bugs. You know that there's a bug here or there, and you're scared that they're going to run into it, and then you're going to have to apologize for it, or you're going to have to say, oh, let me fix that. Even if it was something that you knew in advance, you kind of have to walk this tightrope of, did you know or did you not know? Did you make them use it anyway? And there's a personal reputation, I guess, that you're putting out there when you have them use it too.
Oh, absolutely. I really do think that's sort of the hardest part, is just like having people see it, having them play with it, you know, just seeing where those hiccups are. And I think we sort of over-engineered for scale. We were just like, let's get it ready for when all of the people come. And it would have just been better, I think, to, you know, like reduce some of the time we'd spent building out certain features that in the end were like, it's not even what people really wanted. It was like kind of a bonus, but we didn't know that because we didn't have, I guess, enough volume of voices kind of indicating what the product needed to be. And just over time, as more and more coaches were using it, that's where we realized there was an opportunity to kind of double down and then work with this sort of specific audience. But yeah, it took a while to just get the voices, get people using it, get questions, and just see where those gaps were.
So it sounds like you could have definitely launched sooner. The question is, how much sooner, like I guess in retrospect, how much sooner do you think you could have launched versus when you actually did?
Probably 6 months, if not more.
And most of that's really because you were just hesitant to push it out there and put it in front of more people?
Absolutely. Yeah, we were kind of scared to open the gates.
The other thing it sounds like is like there are places where you wasted time. You specifically said that you over-engineered in some places and maybe it fell short in others. But what other places or ways did you end up wasting time that would have kind of added to that 6 months?
Some of that's tough to answer because I think, you know, Ben on the technical side would have had a bit more insight on that, where like maybe he went down a rabbit hole of, you know, where do we host this thing and kind of how do we, you know, choosing the tech stack. I think there were a few things where, you know, at some point you just have to make a decision, like the text editor, and you make a decision, you choose a tech, and then you realize like that customer support is terrible or it doesn't do what you need it to do. And the time that it takes to kind of switch providers after the fact can add a crap ton of time. So there's a few things like that. I think choosing the technical stack, I'm sure there's a ton of other places that we just sort of wasted time or just maybe didn't get our marketing engine in place. Like we just had no marketing engine and we didn't have any processes around how do we let people know that we are the people that do this, right? We'd been kind of quiet. We'd sort of transitioned our company. And so nobody really knew who we were, what we did. And it's almost like we were afraid to talk about it because then it would become real. People would be checking out the site and the site wasn't ready yet. So there's just a lot of pieces, I think, it's hard to have a strategy up front when you don't necessarily even know how things are going to roll out. So there were just so many unknowns. And I think it's easy to be like, oh, we should have done it this way. But it's our first SaaS. And honestly, this just feels like going to school again. It was like a whole new education.
Right. So I guess at this point, you're kind of getting into the part of the story where you've gone into like a public launch and you've opened up the doors. What did that look like? Did you have like a mailing list that you were sending emails out through, or had you been acquiring people or putting people onto a mailing list? Or was it really just limited to your personal network at that point?
Yeah, we did start an email list really early on, which was great. And it's always kind of surprising when people sign up because, I mean, we had a really, really basic page. Just said, you know, this is what we're up to. If you're curious, sign up. Really basic. A lot of those people came from my own networks because I've been building up my list for years just through my own consulting work at Marie Poulin. And so a lot of people from there and digital strategy school, you know, I was just sort of mentioning it in those groups and just making sure my signature would kind of mention it. And I tried to kind of seed that this is coming. And for any of our clients that were interested in courses too, I'd say like, oh, we're, you know, we're actually building a course. So we did have a list. We tried to keep people updated. We did go through one stretch where I don't even know how long we didn't email people for. And then we sent out this email blast that's like, hey, we've made progress. And then we had a whole bunch of unsubscribes because people are like, who are you? I don't even know. Like, of course, they didn't remember us. And so that was kind of painful, too. And we just realized how important it is to really, really nurture people and keep them in the loop, invite them in. So when we did actually open the doors, it wasn't like this influx of like, we're ready. We did have people respond. We did send out a couple surveys too and just said, you know, where are you in the course launching process? Because if you've signed up for this list, you're probably curious. So are you working on a course? You know, are you running mentorship programs? Like, let us know what you're up to. And just kind of invited people to get in touch. And that actually led to more consulting arrangements, which was, again, kind of interesting. So at this point, I'm taking on these one-on-one consults for people who are asking for help getting launched. And so what I'm trying to do is like figure out where the struggles are in that process, because I know that anyone using our platform is probably going through that behind the scenes. And so it kind of interestingly enough just led to a whole new set of services. So meanwhile, I'm working on these services while Ben is continuing to work on the software. And that's kind of how we ended up divvying things up. So it was a while before we got, you know, our first real paid customers. I mean, it took a couple months to get a few people actually committed to paying. Some of our, you know, best buddies and, you know, some of our colleagues were using it for free, just wanted to get them using it and mentioning it to their networks. But yeah, it took a while. I think we actually within 6 months, we were at 1,000 a month MRR, which we were pretty stoked about. We had no idea if that was realistic or feasible, but then it kind of stagnated and it was just sort of stuck at this like $1,000 a month level. And we realized, oh, right, we actually have to market this thing and get the word out beyond our immediate network.
No, nobody likes marketing. That's, you know, that's not a developer's, you know, developers don't like to do that. That's not a fun thing
no,
to do.
No, they don't. No, no.
It's... But that's also, I think, common to leave that to the end as well, because, you know, you're the developer, or, you know, whoever is the developer is on it is like, I can build all this stuff and I know how to solve these problems. But when it comes to the marketing, you're like, I don't really know where to start. And I'd rather work on something I know how to do.
Yeah. It's that if you build it, they will come. Like, oh, I've built the amazing thing. Well, now we can open the doors. And meanwhile, everyone's kind of moved on to whatever else is solving their problem, right?
Right, right. So kind of the post-launch, you've got $1,000 of MRR, you've got paying customers and people are using it. What happens next? Like, how do you overcome this this plateau that you've kind of reached at $1,000 a month? And what is it that you decided to do and what led you to that decision?
Well, for me, again, just services being my strength, I doubled down on, okay, well, what can I do? Can I work with people one-on-one that can then sort of introduce them to the software? So it's like, let me help you get to the point where you're ready to launch. P.S. We also have this software over here once you're ready, and I will put your content on there. And so I sort of doubled down on that and trying to get known as someone that helps people with the whole sort of end-to-end, you know, customer research side of things, but then the design, the marketing, and then let's get you delivering it on our platform. So I focused on the services there, and Ben also started taking on a little bit more technical clients as well, just, you know, again, just to bring in that revenue. For a while there, he was spending 60% of his time on Doki and maybe 40% on client work to kind of keep paying the bills. And I was doing the client services work. And then that client services work actually led me to create a program called Run Your Learning Launch, which is all geared around, like, let's get the very first version of your launch out the door. You know, I was seeing people take, like, they would hire me to help them launch their program. And then they would take like a year, year and a half. Sometimes people would take 3 years to get their course idea out the door because they were just building it up in their heads. They're doing the same thing that people in software do. You spend so much time building the thing before you've talked to humans. So I realized there was a bit of an educational gap or a need here that I could fill. So I launched Run Your Learning Launch, and that was a chance to kind of get people launching quickly. And we bundled that with Doki so that people could get a feel for the platform and just see how they could get people using their course, even if it was in a rough state, just because of the features that we'd built to be able to launch your course in a multitude of different ways.
I think the insight that you kind of gained there was that there's this spectrum of, you know, what people need versus what they're willing to pay for and what they're willing to do. And on the one end of it, you know, like they've got the money, but they don't have the time or the expertise. And that's really where your consulting services come in. And then, you know, on the clear other end of the spectrum, you've got the software itself, which can do it for them, but they still have to do the work. And that's more of a, that's completely self-serve at that point. And really you're saying, well, you had to kind of go in their direction, at least to some extent. And that's where things like productized services come in or courses come in, where you can prepackage something and say, here, let me teach you how to do this, and you can still do it, but I'm going to educate you about how. It's like a meeting them halfway. Sometimes the productized service is not just the educational content and you hand it over, but it's helping them along in a very regimented way. And it sounds like you're kind of going in that direction at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the insights too is just realizing that some of the people I had originally worked with one-on-one, who we were doing these like big custom engagements for, they were already pretty savvy about creating content. So then when we created a software, the software really depended on people already being really comfortable with content creation. So we were getting people signing up for the software that had maybe never created a product before and didn't really know what to expect. So in a way, I don't think we realized it, but our software was catering to a slightly different audience, someone with less experience. And so that's when we realized, ooh, we need to get them to that experience level so that they feel confident enough launching. So yeah, it's just been like finding the opportunities to build more of like a holistic product and services umbrella. So we've got the software, we've got one-on-one services, we've got courses, you know, some of them are evergreen, some of them are coaching programs that we do with you. And just, it's almost like, what's your budget and what depth, you know, do you want to go through with us to get where you want to go? We have something for you at every level.
Was there ever an inclination or a desire on your part to say, okay, yes, we're just getting the wrong people in here, so let's avoid them and try to find the marketing channel where we only get the people who know what they're doing and try to serve them through the software? Or was that, were you getting too many people coming in that would otherwise be a good fit? They just didn't quite know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think we realized that people that had already previously run coaching programs were going to be a better fit for us. And that's something that I learned too. I just started doing virtual coffee dates with people. Every week I would just, you know, whether it's Friday morning, I would set up dates with people just to ask them what they were doing in their business, especially coaches, just to see like, what does your onboarding look like? And what is it, walk me through the process of someone first hiring you to getting educated about what to expect next, to how to book a call with you, like walk me through that process. And just those conversations kind of led to a number of insights. And we just realized people who were already experienced with launching, but maybe didn't have the tech to kind of seamlessly pull those pieces together, were obviously a better fit for us. But I didn't want to necessarily turn away from people that didn't have that experience and maybe still wanted to launch, you know, smaller evergreen courses. So we sort of built a course to fill the one need, and then we've got our one-on-one services to fit the other need. But yeah, once we realized that coaches, kind of experienced coaches, were a better fit and kind of already had the money ready to go and were willing to invest it, that's when I knew I needed to just be speaking with more coaches, get more coaches on the platform, and just, I guess, have more coaches even letting their friends know, like, oh, did you know about Doki? Like, I run my program on it. This is how it works. So we sort of relied on a bit of that word of mouth marketing from coaches.
And kind of the bottom line of all that is really that stuff that you could not have possibly known in advance of launching. You had to launch in order to get to the point where you are talking to these people and enough of these people to be able to have that insight.
Yeah. And you may have a vision for your product when you first start. And we sort of did. Like, we were just thinking like, we're a course platform. And then it's like, oh, actually, we're way more than that. Oh, people can run group programs. Oh, masterminds. Oh, we see this is trending. And you can kind of start to pivot. But until you get people using it, you have no idea. And it became a bit of a differentiator for us too, because we were able to speak to, oh, this is why we are different than some of those bigger players, because we understand the needs intimately of this group of people. So yeah, those conversations were key. And anyone who signed up in the first year, we'd shoot them an email with a booking link and just be like, hey, wanna hop on a call with us? We'd be happy to chat. Yeah, and that was something I learned at MicroConf too, right? It's just doing things that don't scale from the beginning to get those insights. And so we just said, book calls with us. Like, we want to talk to anyone who even, you know, signed up for a trial and actually clicked purchase. We want to know what state of mind they're in, you know, what they're struggling in their business. And those insights have just really led to amazing marketing copy and just really narrowing in where we think the product needs to go.
I think part of the struggle there is that as the people who designed the software, like, you have this idea in your head of how it's going to be used and what it's going to be used for, and you don't realize all the other different use cases that people might be signing up for, or the other problems that they're trying to solve that are tangential but don't completely line up with exactly what it was that you intended. And it allows you to pivot to one side or the other, or kind of shift your focus a little bit.
And it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? Because you can have one person come in and say, and we did have someone that said, hey, I want to use your product like a company wiki. So when people, let's say they're training new employees, and you'd have this place where someone could log in and basically see where all the branding assets are and see kind of how the company runs things. And okay, an internal company wiki, we didn't really see that coming. Sure, the product can do that.
But that sounds really dangerous to, like, listen to them too.
Yes, exactly. So it's like, it's fine to let that person use the product that way. But what happens when that person's like, hey, would you be willing to build a feature that, you know, builds on this thing here and does XYZ? And you want to make sure, obviously, that you're not going down these rabbit holes and just building out any tech that people are asking you for. And so I think it can be tricky to weigh in, well, how much revenue are these kinds of clients bringing in? Is there an opportunity to do enterprise level engagements? And what do those look like? And it can be easy, I think, especially with a small team, to get a little distracted and off track. And, you know, a few times Ben has done really custom requests for people, especially, again, we're small and we want to just really nail the customer service side of things and keep people happy. So he's done a couple things where he's built out some ridiculous request for people that maybe added weeks and weeks of time. And in some cases, you know, we try to only do that if we know that it benefits the greater vision of the product. Other times it's led to going down a rabbit hole where we say, maybe that was not the best use of our time for a $29 a month customer, right? So it can get tricky to balance those requests.
Does it make it hard for you to tell those customers no as well? Because like, if you don't have a lot of customers coming through to begin with, like, what do you tell somebody when what they're asking for really doesn't match your roadmap?
I mean, we're pretty honest when people ask those questions. We just say, you know, we'll take that into consideration. If we notice a lot of people asking for that same feature, we're always happy to take those feature requests. And we let people know, kind of, here's what's in the pipeline for XYZ reasons. Here's why we're not actually going in that direction. And in some cases, we've actually said, like, you know what, if that's how you want to use it, our software may not be the best fit for you. You may want to consider XYZ. And, you know, Ben will send them a list of competitor products because we know that that's going to work better for them. So we're pretty honest about it. We let people know if it makes sense and if it doesn't.
So after you have launched the product and you're starting to learn from these customers and identify what it is that is resonating with them and use that information to put as copy on the website and in emails, and you're building out your onboarding a little bit, did you look at your competitors to see what it was that they were doing and try to kind of copy some of the marketing techniques? Is that something you looked at, or did it just not lead you anywhere?
It was certainly hard not to look at our competitors. It sort of felt like, you know, every few months we'd see someone that was doing what we were doing, but doing it better and doing it with like a gigantic marketing team or VC funding. And it was hard not to say, like, oh, like, we are small potatoes. How can we possibly compete with these people? And again, like, a lot of them aren't necessarily doing the coaching angle per se, but yeah, it was intimidating looking at our competitors. And so we tried to look, what can we learn? What can we take from this? And where are the gaps that we need to fill for ourselves with our content marketing? You know, there were a few things. Like, I saw a competitor email that was very creatively worded, that was like, you know, the top percentage of our percentage of courses. And it was kind of misleading, because we've seen it. We know that a lot of people that make courses, they often don't make the sales that they're expecting. And so it's really only a top percentage of people that are really succeeding with their online courses and like really making a good chunk of money. And I think some of our competitors are like, online courses will save your life and they will, you know, you can sit back and the cash is going to come rolling in. And, you know, I wrote a blog.
They're selling the dream is really what it comes down to.
100% selling the dream. And I get it. It supports, you know, using their product. And I have a hard time with that. So I write blog posts that are like, why you shouldn't make an online course. And is that foolish? You know, is it foolish to educate people and say, like, maybe you actually don't want to do this right now? Maybe it's not necessarily in my best interest, but I'm hoping that there's sort of long-term trust being built and just saying, I get this space. I get the things that are happening. I've just seen so many people not follow through on their ideas. And it kind of breaks my heart. But I think I want more people launching, but I also want people being more realistic that this can be a great supplement to your business. It doesn't have to replace your business income, but what would you do with an extra $1,000 a month on autopilot? That's awesome for, you know, the average entrepreneur that comes to see me and just wants some extra cash. Like, that's great for a lot of people. So I think selling that six-figure dream is something that we just are not willing to do.
I think there's a lot of people that kind of fit that mold as well. I mean, I would certainly count myself in that group as where, like, you don't want to come out and try to sell people on something that you know is probably unrealistic for most of them. I mean, there's certainly going to be a small percentage, maybe it's 5%, maybe it's even 1% that are going to be able to do that. But then there's this huge chunk of people who come in and, quite frankly, you don't want to take their money if it's going to be a waste of their money. So it's a difficult position to be in.
And I've told, you know, services people too, I'm like, no, actually, like, you're not ready to pay me this amount every month because you don't actually really have a product yet, or you haven't found that product market fit. So to hire me to help you build out some funnel for a product that doesn't really exist or make sense, or it's going to take you a while, I have no problem telling people that they're not in the right place to work with me. But my hope is that I would have at least something like, oh, maybe you want to take my course first, you know, take my learning launch course and like get a first version of a thing out first. Then I can work with you a little closer one-on-one. So I have no problem kind of, sometimes I feel like a bit of a dream killer when I just tell people like, yeah, no, that's probably not going to be. And that was something we actually learned. Like, we did the Run Your Learning Launch Bootcamp last year, and we had a couple people in there that I felt sort of had some unrealistic expectations about, like, I can't wait to, you know, make six figures with this course. And they hadn't done that work with anybody one-on-one yet. So the idea of just building sort of a passive income machine for something that you haven't really done, have a ton of experience doing with people one-on-one in some capacity, I just felt gross about it. And I was like, I don't know who's selling this dream. It's just really unrealistic. And we realized for the next version of Run Your Learning Launch that I needed to be way more specific about who this course was for. And we did recommend you should probably have been blogging for a little bit or have some experience creating some level of content. Because to start from scratch trying to build a course when you've got no presence, you've got no reputation, or just nobody knows what your ideas are and kind of what you stand for, it's almost like you got to do that audience building even before you think about doing the course.
So in addition, the other thing that kind of comes to my mind is that you said that you looked at your competitors and saw what they were doing from a marketing standpoint. But, you know, one of your early observations about this was that it took you a long time to get to launch. And during that time, I would imagine that there were other people who came out with similar software or software products that did the same kinds of things. Like, what did that make you feel like when you saw those things? Was it, I wish we'd launched sooner, or we could do that with if we were funded? Like, what sort of thoughts went through your head?
Yeah, lots of painful thoughts, flip the table thoughts, like, oh, maybe we should just throw in the towel. What are we doing? Like, you know, should have gotten to market sooner. Or, you know, sometimes we'd look at one of the competitors and be like, eh, they got nothing on us. Like, we're fine. It was a roller coaster for sure. Every time we'd see, like, there were quite a few that seemed to pop up in the span of us getting ready to launch. And so, yeah, it makes you doubt. It makes you wonder, like, what are we doing? Is it worth it? Do we double down on this? How do we differentiate in a very busy market? I mean, luckily, we still were able to kind of double down on the feature that took us the longest to build and I think prevented us from getting to launch was this unique packaging feature that allows somebody to market, sell the same course in a variety of formats. Again, like whether it's drip only four of these eight modules and only let these people in. And so in a way, it took us the longest to build, but it is still actually one of the biggest differentiators. And we kind of lean on that when we talk to people and say, this is one reason that coaches use our product, because they can sell the same course as an evergreen or do it as a live version with a group of people. And just the ease of being able to do that with one click. I remember talking to a girl who had used a competitor product, and she said she had 49 different versions of her course. Duplicate, delete module, like just so many different versions, because she had all these different funnels set up. And I realized she could literally set that up in like a couple minutes on our platform. But again, once people are kind of invested in a platform, it's hard to get them to switch. And so, yeah, it's been an interesting challenge, but we try to double down on the feature that we know is our big differentiator. But that, it's nerve-wracking too, right? When your differentiator is a feature. So what happens when one of those platforms goes, cool, we're going to add that? Does that totally invalidate our product, right? So how do we continue to make sure that our product serves a certain audience and feels valuable? Yeah, it's hard to compete when you've got people who've got that VC money, and but you can hope that, you know, they want to take the product in their direction and you're taking it in your direction, and that you're going to serve a very specific audience of people. And we've talked about the future of the product and said, like, how long do we give it to hit a certain MRR before we decide, well, maybe this isn't for us, you know? And also maybe we don't need it to be this gigantic monstrosity of our revenue. Like, could we be happy if it replaced one of our salaries and kind of runs on autopilot, which is pretty awesome. So, you know, we kind of go back and forth with that, but so far we're pretty happy.
Do you find that those conversations with the customers that have been using another product are easier to have because you have come across their shortcomings and you can speak directly to them?
Yes. And I think it's kind of a bonus that, like, we'll have people come to our platform from other platforms and be like, oh, I hate that, you know, platform X doesn't do blank. We're like, oh, that's really good to know. So a lot of it's in our customers' words, and we can kind of lean on that and say, oh, well, you know, our customers have mentioned, you know, they really like this about, you know, some people have mentioned that some of our competitors feels like it was designed by engineers. Like, maybe the usability isn't as nice or that sort of thing. So yeah, it's, you know, at first in the beginning, Ben would sort of be like, well, fine, use competitor X. And I was like, you know, maybe, but also why don't we speak to that feature that really is a differentiator, even if it doesn't feel like it's the biggest deal for the right person? It's going to be exactly the right thing that they're looking for.
Yeah. At one point for BlueTick, I was having people fill out a survey before where they would even sign up for a demo. And one of the questions I had asked was, what other products have you tried in the past and what didn't work and why? And I found that by using that, like, I could directly use the customer's words back to them in conversation, and it very easily resonated with them. And a lot of the things that they had said were things that I had designed around to begin with because I'd done the customer validation. But it just knowing those things makes it so much easier to talk directly to those pain points. Even if you have a hard time putting it in words on the website, talking to somebody directly, it gives you a much better, I'll say, pulpit of authority to kind of talk to them about it.
Absolutely. There's gold in those customer interviews.
So I guess to kind of reflect back on what you've gone through, like, are there any specific insights or the specific mistakes that you've made along the way that if you were to go through it again, you absolutely wouldn't do it this particular way, or you would absolutely do this particular thing over here?
I mean, there's a few things where we look back and say, like, oh, we would have chosen this tech instead of that tech. I do think we would have launched our alpha sooner, probably would have just sort of hand onboarded people right from the beginning to get them using it, even in a rough state. We might have even done, like, just prototypes, right? Like screen prototypes or even paper prototypes. Obviously, way more customer validation and just conversations right from the beginning. And even surveys like that, like, let's talk to people who've already launched online courses and programs and whatnot. So I think a lot more research would have gone in the beginning, a lot more marketing before the product was ready, so that it's not like asking for the sale is not the first time that people are hearing from you. That would have been a huge one, I think. Way more nurturing before our product was ready, and just building more buzz and kind of sharing behind the scenes and even sharing why we were compelled to build the product itself. Those are definitely some things we would have done a little differently.
Awesome. So one last question kind of to add on to that, like, are there things that you're doing right now that you know in the back of your mind you shouldn't be doing?
Oh, good question.
Or you should be, like, because, for example, I mean, you called out, you should have been sending more emails. Are you still not doing certain things that you know you should be?
Absolutely. I think we're pretty terrible with our email consistency, for sure. You know, I've always been self-conscious about not wanting to be in people's inbox and pestering them and whatnot. So I think that's something that we can certainly do better. And content marketing as well, just being really strategic and making sure that we are answering questions that people really have and not just sort of like I guess, blogging in a general sense. Like, let's make sure that we are really specific with the content that we're creating and that it really is serving our other products and services. So, more content marketing and just being smarter about our email. And one thing we want to experiment a little bit with that we haven't been doing is just any kind of paid advertising, whether it's Google AdWords or Facebook ads or you name it. We have no experience on the paid marketing side of things. So we want to do a bit of exploration there.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to leave off this with. So if people who are listening to this have any questions or they want to find you and talk to you a little bit more about what your software is and maybe launch their own courses, where could they find out more about you?
Yeah, you can. Our website is weareokidoki.com. And if you ever want to kind of reach out and send me a personal message, you can find me on Twitter at Marie Poulin. I'm also pretty active on Instagram too. And I love to share Instagram stories of kind of behind the scenes and what I'm working on there. So definitely follow me there too, if you like that. But otherwise, yeah, you can find me and Ben both on Twitter. We're pretty active on there. Ben is Type 1 Error.
Well, thanks very much, Marie. Just wanted to say thanks for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. It was wonderful talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupstherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.